G'day wherever you may be around the world, and thank you for your company on truth2u.org. That's truth2u.org. Joining me this hour for the first time on Truth To You is one of the world's foremost authorities on missionaries, cults, and the Jewish community. He is the Director of Education and Counseling for Jews for Judaism in Canada. The website is jewsforjudaism.ca. That's jewsforjudaism.ca. Welcome to the program, Rabbi Michael Skovak.
Hey, it's so great to be here with you, Jono.
It's wonderful to have you on the program. Finally, for the first time, I'm very excited. And now what we want to talk about, so many times I have been told over and over again that there are hundreds of messianic prophecies in the Tanakh, in the Jewish scriptures, that point to the fact, the undeniable fact, that Jesus, Yeshua, is the Jewish Messiah. And when I say hundreds, I usually hear the figure over 300, 300 or more. In fact, and people can do this, if they go online and they put in fulfilled prophecies Jesus in a Google search, whatever it may be, you're going to get a whole lot of lists. No one can really agree on what, how many fulfilled prophecies there are. But generally what I see is 300 or more. I saw 365. How convenient that there's 365 prophecies, one for every single day of the year. We're going to go through that list and just take it back to the Tanakh and see what it actually says and whether or not it's fair to call this a prophecy fulfilled. Now, Rabbi Skovak, you were telling me that you've even seen lists of 600.
Yeah, I've seen people claiming over 600.
Over 600?
Yeah, you know, it reminds me of these commercials that you've seen sometimes for household cleaners. And they'll say, you know, our product has 1,000 uses. And, you know, when you try to find out what these uses are, they'll say, well, it'll clean basement windows and bathroom windows and kitchen windows and clean your mirrors. I mean, end of the day, there aren't really 1,000 uses. And when I've spoken with Christians over the years, I've often asked people, said, look, let's just talk man to man here. You know, let's just be honest. Do you really think there are 300 prophecies that point clearly and unequivocally to Jesus?
This is exactly the question, because even if there's only half of that, even if there's only 150, even if there's 53, even if there's 22, then you've got to say that there's a case. Now, but before we jump into the lists and start going through them, and we're going to do that systematically in the order that they appear in the Christian Bible, before we even do that, we kind of need to set the ground rules, don't we? I mean, there's a game to be played here. There's got to be rules by which we should abide, and people should be aware of the rules of play before we begin, because we've got the board in front of us. We've got 365 pieces on the board. We got to know what we're doing. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think that, you know, when it comes to understanding the Bible, you know, there are usually ways in which reasonable people can agree about what a text actually means clearly and when the text is not so clear. And I think what's important to highlight from the very beginning is that we have a saying in Hebrew, rabbis always say, Bari v'shema, Bari adif, that if something is clear and something is certain and something is maybe and something is perhaps, the clear takes precedence over the perhaps. Mm-hmm. And what I always try to highlight when I'm teaching is that, you know, when we look at the passages in the Bible that Judaism has historically insisted point to the Messiah, the character of the Messiah in the Bible, I would say that those passages are clear, that any person reading the Bible would admit that those passages are speaking about the Messiah. And that, to me, is really the criteria for clarity. The criteria for clarity is when everyone agrees, meaning that when people who normally disagree end up agreeing and saying, yes, indeed, we both see this passage in the same way, you know it's got to be pretty clear. When people
That's compelling. Yeah, that's fair enough.
Yeah, and I think that the same way, the criteria for something that's not clear is when reasonable people disagree. So I think that what I find important to point out from the beginning is that when we look at passages in the Bible like Isaiah chapter 11 or Jeremiah chapter 23 or Ezekiel chapter 37, These are all passages where students of the Bible, whether they're Jewish or Christian, agree that these passages are speaking about the Messiah. Mm-hmm. And so Judaism at least feels a certain level of comfort in advancing its picture of the Messiah, because we base it upon passages where there's really no disagreement. Mm-hmm. And we're going to see that one of the major problems with this list of 365 proofs is that it's hard to call something a proof when it's not clear. Meaning that I would imagine that we would feel that you could make the case or make the argument that you have evidence or proof when what you're pointing to is clear. But mm-hmm. if what you're pointing to is not clear, then I think it's very difficult to say that it's proof. You can say it's your opinion, but there's a far cry from someone's opinion to proof or to evidence, clear evidence. Mm-hmm. And I think that's going to be part of what we will be seeing over the coming sessions, is that it could be that Christians have a point of view when it comes to their understanding or interpretation of a certain text. But I would say that those passages are not necessarily so clear, and there may be equally valid and compelling other interpretations, at which point one side cannot say they have proof anymore. You can't say that you have a slam dunk proof when there are other perspectives that read the same passage in a very different way. So I think that's one thing to bear in mind. I think also, I'll just go back to this number for a moment. I think it's important to understand, you know, why would, because you said something important, that even if there were only a dozen passages that pointed to Jesus, that would be a case. And that's true. You know, we'd have to then evaluate those dozen passages. Mm-hmm. But the question is, why do so many Christians feel compelled to pump that up to 300 or 600? And I think part of it is an intimidation factor. I know that my brother is a lawyer and tells me that sometimes in a legal case, the attorneys might come into the courtroom with a wheelbarrow full of evidence. Mm-hmm. You know, it's intimidating when, you know, people see, you know, piles and piles and piles of folders and files, because
well,
it looks
you
like...
know, it's interesting. It's interesting that you should say that, because having come out of the Christian church, it is my experience that, as I said before, you would often hear these numbers thrown around, over 300 prophecies fulfilled in the Tanakh. But, I mean, who's going to go through? I mean, I didn't. You hear that and you think, even if half of it is true, it's not bad. I mean, come on.
Exactly.
300, and then the ones that they usually, and we will get to these, but as I said, if only 53 of them are true, or only if 22 of them are true, what I'm alluding to, of course, is Isaiah 53, Psalm 22, and we will get to those eventually. But this is that you usually hear about these ones first, and you're easily convinced. And if they say there's 300, and here's a couple here, and you're pretty convinced about that, why do you need to go back and look at all 300? Of course, it's compelling. It's overwhelming evidence. Say no more.
Exactly, meaning that it's a technique. It's a it's like a technique of propaganda to almost cut short someone's ability to examine a case when they just feel that, you know, it's impossible to look at all this. So I think it's important to just sort of bear in mind why these inflated numbers are bandied about so often, when at the end of the day, most Christians that I've spoken to will tell me, you know, the number is closer to 10 or 15 passages. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, a person could feel that that's a reasonable amount of work to go through to examine 10 or 15
Indeed.
Passages.
So true.
Now, I think it's I'll point something else out that I think that people often don't think about. And this struck me a few years ago, that, you know, you mentioned Isaiah 53 and Psalm 22, and I would throw into the mix Zechariah 12 and
sure.
Daniel 9. And, you know, these are the real serious passages that ultimately need to be examined carefully. These are, I would say, the stars among these hundreds of passages. These are the ones that...
Because there is a short list, right? I mean, you don't go to a church and they do a sermon on all 300.
Right.
365. They're going to pull out the short list, and those ones are, they're the stars of the show, no doubt about it.
Those are the ones that are compelling. But I think that if we look at the ones that seem to be the ones that are compelling, like Isaiah 53, which speaks about the suffering and the death of the Messiah, or Psalm 22, which speaks about the alleged crucifixion of the Messiah, or Daniel 9, which speaks about when the Messiah is going to be killed, or Zechariah 12, which speaks of the piercing of the Messiah. These are all passages, when we think about it for a moment, that only become relevant after Jesus is dead. Now, in terms of what happens historically, you know, Jesus is not claiming to be the Messiah in the year 2014. Jesus was claiming to be the Messiah years before he was killed.
Mm-hmm.
And it's important to remember that, you know, if Jesus was not the Messiah when he was claiming to be the Messiah, then the case doesn't get better years later, meaning that he was making the forceful claim while he was alive that he was the Messiah. And he was actually very critical of anyone that would question that.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone that would question whether he's the Messiah, you know, was in for very rough treatment by Jesus.
Certainly.
He was assuming that people would accept his claim while he was alive. And while he was alive, he wouldn't be able to point to Isaiah 53 or Daniel 9 or Psalm 22 or Zechariah mm-hmm. 12 because he hadn't been killed yet. And I would say that if he wasn't the Messiah while he was alive, which is, again, when he was making the claim, and when the Jewish people who knew him in person would be able to evaluate the claim, if he was not the Messiah while he was alive, he doesn't then become the Messiah years later. I mean, that his claim to being the Messiah had to be evaluated at the time he made the claim. And so it's important when we're going through these proof texts to realize that the stars and the ones that are the most compelling are only passages that became relevant years after he made his claim. That's just a methodological idea that I think is important to remember.
Mm-hmm.
I think another thing to realize, and this is maybe not always the case, but for many people I think this is the case, that Christians that are making this claim are usually making it to non-believers, meaning that this is part of the sales pitch, that they're approaching non-believers with the claim that Jesus must have been the Messiah because he fulfilled hundreds of prophecies.
Mm.
Now, the problem is that for most people that are not believers, it's not just that they don't believe that Jesus was the Messiah. They also don't really necessarily believe in the authority of the Bible. Mm-hmm. And so one of the problems is that, you know, you'll often hear people when they give their testimony and that you ask them, you know, how did you come to believe in Jesus? They'll say that, well, because I saw so many prophecies fulfilled. I saw that he fulfilled prophecies in this book of the Bible and that book of the Bible. But the truth is that at the moment that they were first shown these prophecies, they were not living their life based upon the Bible. For example, Jewish people who often come to faith in Jesus, you know, if you would stop them a month before they gave their, they put their faith in Jesus, and you asked them, you know, why they weren't observing the Sabbath or the dietary laws, because they're clearly written in the Bible, they weren't about to change their life because you pointed out passages in the book of Exodus or Deuteronomy. Because for the most part, they didn't really care what the Bible said.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happens is when they later report that they came to believe in Jesus because of what the Bible said, I think it's invariably never true. I think that what happens is they accept Jesus for other reasons. I think often because their impression of Christians and the Christian walk is that they're impressed with the spirituality and the passion and the likability of Christians. And that's what draws
And the emotional appeal is something else that I've often encountered. It's the emotional appeal and experience of Christianity that they're attracted to.
Very much so. And I think what happens is that that's the reason they come to believe in Jesus, because ultimately it really feels good. And I think the problem is that people don't like to think about themselves that they made the kind of decision in life that ultimately has alienated their friends and family, because that's what often happens when people give their life to Jesus. They really lose a lot of friends and family members. they don't like to think that they made that kind of a monumental decision because it felt good. And I think they like to be able to feel that, no, this was an intellectual decision. This mm-hmm. is the truth. The Bible says this. But I think that really, in my experience, most people that I've met didn't go from the Bible to Jesus. They went from Jesus to the Bible, meaning once they came to faith in Jesus, it's only then afterward that the Bible becomes important to them, because it becomes the intellectual matrix for their conversion experience. They're able to now think about themselves as if they made an intellectual decision rather than an emotional decision.
Sure. And that's I would have to say that concurs with my, and in my experience as well, and people that I've met and have said similar things. Their interest in what the Bible actually says is born out of some kind of attack on their newly found decision. They don't want to look silly. They now need to feel. They now feel they need some kind of apologetics to justify their decision, and then they start breezing through some of these so-called prophecies.
Yeah, I think you know, just when we think about how people relate to all these prophecies, I think this is an important base to touch on before we get started. Mm. I think another thing that I just point out, maybe these are not in any particular order, is that I think often you'll find that Christian apologists will present their case, or they will present the way they read these passages in the Bible, often in a similar way to the way conspiracy theorists advance their theories. You know, the Bible is not always a very, very easy book to read. And what sometimes happens is people will look at a passage in the Bible and they will point out a difficulty, an anomaly, something that's not clear, a question, a problem. And they will sometimes raise you know, a good question about what the Bible seems to be saying, or what the Bible how the Bible reads. And it's very much the way conspiracy theorists will present their ideas. You know, for example, there are people who believe that the World Trade Center was not brought down by Al-Qaeda or Islamic terrorists. You know, they believe that somehow the American government planted explosives and blew up these buildings. Mm-hmm. And what they'll do is they'll go through the events of that day, and they'll ask questions. They'll say, well, why is it that, you know, building number 7, you know, only collapsed later on? Or why is it that the hole in the Pentagon seem to be smaller than the wingspan of a 747. You know, it's easy to look at an event and to ask questions.
Sure.
And to point out difficulties or anomalies. Mm-hmm. And then what happens is, you know, the questions in many ways is irrelevant, because they're all questions that are really transparent questions, because they're a way of ultimately advancing their thesis, which is really what they want to advance, regardless of the questions or even how the questions should be answered, meaning that mm-hmm. you know, they're convinced that there was a conspiracy. They're convinced that, you know, it was the Zionists who blew up the World Trade Center or the American government. And these questions are a way of muddying the waters and often confusing people. And then at the end, this becomes sort of the simple answer. So when we read the Bible, we'll often read parts of the Bible that are not necessarily easy to understand at first blush, you know, prima facie. And, you know, there may be, for example, an allusion to, you know, someone is going to return after 3 days. Well, what is that talking about? It may not be immediately clear from the passage what it's talking about. And so it's very easy to seize on this and say, well, you know, someone coming back after 3 days, it has to be referring to the resurrection of Jesus.
And that's what's called a hint, right? This is what I often hear, is that, well, such references are hinted throughout. They're hinted throughout. And what they mean by that is a combination of similar words or an interesting event that parallels with the events of Jesus or something like that, by which they can look at and go, ah, only with spiritual eyes can you understand and see that. That's a hint. And to illustrate that further, I get that a lot if I ask people in regards to Luke chapter 24, just jumping into the New Testament, and verses 44 and on, Jesus is telling his disciples, he said, you guys, you got to understand that these things must be fulfilled, which was written in the Torah and the prophets and the Psalms concerning me. And he goes on to say that that it was necessary for the Christ to suffer and rise from the dead on the third day. And you ask them, well, whereabouts does it say that in the Torah and the prophets and the Psalms? And quite often, invariably, in fact, I will get the word, well, it's hinted throughout. There are allusions throughout. And from that, we derive it all. We get the bigger picture, and lo and behold, Jesus is the Messiah.
Yeah, so this is really lies at the heart, really, of the, I would say, the critique of this, you know, this Christian claim here that the Bible points clearly and unequivocally to Jesus, meaning that, you know, it's one thing to say there's clear, unequivocal evidence where if you read the Bible clearly and plainly for what the Bible clearly and plainly teaches, you will see that there's no other way of reading it other than it revealing that Jesus was the Messiah. That's a far cry from saying that, well, you know, there are these veiled hints and clues and, you know, types and clouds
types, yeah.
and
shadows. Shadows,
yeah. Because the reality is, the truth is, that you can ultimately read any text and find shadows and clues and hints for literally anything in the world. I read a wonderful book years ago by a literary critic named Frederick C. Cruz, I think his name was. And the book is called The Pooh Perplex. And it's an unbelievable book. It's basically a book of literary criticism, but it's a satire. And he has about a dozen essays about Winnie the Pooh. And in each essay, he basically takes the perspective that Winnie the Pooh is either a Marxist, political tract, or it's some kind of Freudian sexual story, or it's some kind of a Christological story. But he comes up with 12 very, very different angles to Winnie the Pooh and what it really is all about. And he finds incredible hints and clues throughout the story to advance each perspective. And what was wonderful about this book was that when I read it, I really couldn't tell if he was writing it tongue-in-cheek or if he was serious.
This reminds me of, and you'll find, and listeners can do this, get online and have a look at some of the political studies on the book Wizard of Oz, and you'll find some similar things.
Well, I mean, this book was actually written tongue-in-cheek, but it was done so well that you couldn't tell, meaning that he did such a compelling job of proving each one of these approaches to Winnie the Pooh through literary analysis that you just were scratching your head as you were reading it. Is this fellow pulling my leg, or is this for real? And what you see from this kind of a book, and there are many other examples, but basically if you're approaching a document and your method of analysis is hints and types and clues and
shadows. You're going to find,
things
you're
like
always
going
to find something that you can turn into some sort of support for your agenda. I've done this with my children. I've said to them, and it's called apophenia. You can look at a body of text and derive from it whatever you want, just by words that have meaning to you to support whatever your presupposition is. They don't have to be connected. They don't have to be relevant. You just simply derive from a body of text whatever little hints or shadows you will, and come up with a bigger picture. And I said, if you go get one of the children books, go get any book that you want, give it to me. Let's have Jesus in mind in the New Testament, and let's go through this book, and let's see if we can find little hints here and there about the nature and life of Jesus. And it's not too long before you find a page where you can go, ah, we could say that this means that. And we've done it so many times, and it's a lot of fun. An Encyclopedia Britannica, the newspaper, whatever it may be, any body of text, you can play this game with.
Well,
right?
More than just text, by the way. I mean, just an interesting analogy is that, you know, think of all the news stories that you read about people who see a water stain on the side of a bridge, or, you know, some oil formation in a pizza, and they say, "You see, that's the face of Jesus."
It's the burnt piece of it's the burn mark in the piece of toast.
Well, so the point is that, you know, no one knows what Jesus looked like, but if you have in your mind what you think Jesus looked like, you'll find it anywhere. You know, they say that Mark Twain used to say that to a person with a hammer, everything looks like a nail. So the person that is, you know, hell-bent on finding Jesus on every page of the Bible, they will. I mean, years ago, I met with a woman, and I said to her, you know, I think that when you read the Jewish Bible, you see Jesus' picture on every page. You see his face on every page. And she said, well, how did you know? That's exactly what happens. When I read the Jewish Bible, she said, that's exactly what I see. I see Jesus' face on every single page. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, I'll tell you what I think really happens. I said to her that, you know, my wife is a painter, an artist, and she paints seascapes. Now, my wife happens to do abstract seascapes, but she once took me to an art exhibit at a museum of oil paintings. And these were quite amazing, because if you looked at the oil paintings of these seascapes from across the room from a certain distance, they looked so realistic that you could imagine that if you touched this canvas, your hand would get wet. It looked like there was actually water there. And wow. I said that this only works because of the illusion of distance. But if you walk very close up to the canvas, you just see basically it's splotches of oil, and you're going to see all the cracks and imperfections. I remember a couple of years ago, someone came to my office. They were coming in for some counseling, and they were very shocked. They saw that on my wall, I had a picture of Marilyn Monroe. And they looked at me, and they said, wow, I'm shocked that a rabbi would have Marilyn Monroe's picture up on the wall. So I said, well, you're not standing close enough to us. I said, go stand a little bit closer. And the fellow walked right up to it, and he jumped out of his shoes, and he said, oh, my God, that's Albert Einstein. So it's a very famous illusion that from
I've
a
seen
distance,
that illusion. I've seen it on Facebook.
Yeah, when you look far away from something, you know, it could look, you know, totally wrong. And so I said to this woman, I said, it's true that you see Jesus on every page of the Bible, because you're really looking at the Bible from very, very far away. But if you look very, very close up, you'll see that it doesn't really apply to Jesus. And I don't know.
And that's what we want to do. We want to have a look at some of these claims and just get a little closer and see whether or not it does in fact apply. That's fair, right?
I think that's really our enterprise, what our project's going to be. And I think that you know, they sometimes say that these 300 proof texts are like cotton candy. You know, when you bite into cotton candy, it very quickly disappears, like nothing is there. So I think what happens is, and I believe that most Christians I've spoken to agree with me, that when you really look at these carefully, they very quickly evaporate, and there's really no real evidence pointing to Jesus in the vast majority of these. And I think that at the end of the day, there are only about a dozen that we have to really discuss. But I think that, you know, we'll see that as we go through them, there are certain typical problems that repeat over and over and over again. And sometimes, you know, the problem will be simply a problem of mistranslation. And, you know, that's not all that frequent. It comes up a number of times. But usually we're going to see that the problem is one of taking a passage out of context. Mm-hmm. And the Talmud says, interesting, there's a passage in the Talmud which says that whenever people try to use the Bible for their own agenda, people that are heretics that are trying to prove their false ideology by using the Jewish Bible, the Talmud says that you should look very close by to the text they're quoting. I mean, that what usually is happening is that the proof text is really an isolating one verse usually, or even part of a verse, but it's isolating it from the general context of the passage. And, you know, so you might be taking a passage where this Christian proof text, you know, you're parachuting down into the middle of a chapter and reading a verse out of the context of the general passage, the general chapter, or even out of the context of the chapters that are around there, and sort of imposing a view on this isolated verse that has nothing to do with the context of the chapter. And we're going to see this is the general flaw in virtually all of these proof texts.
So the original language, the context of the quote, and the historical understanding are three very powerful tools that we're going to be using when it comes to these so-called prophecies. That's fair?
Yeah, I think that the issue of context is going to be really the most serious issue, meaning that the real question is going to be, in most cases, are we really looking at a messianic prophecy? Meaning, are we really looking at a passage where, if we read the passage in context of the whole chapter and the whole book, the author is really trying to teach us something about the Messiah? Or is this just a soundbite that's been pulled out of a whole chapter where the chapter has nothing to do with the topic of the Messiah, but because that soundbite sounds like Jesus, it then gets rubber stamped as a messianic prophecy? You know, the analogy I once heard was that the Christian approaches the Bible like the trial in Alice in Wonderland. You know, the trial there, they had a verdict and then a trial. Normally, you're supposed to have a trial and then a verdict. And so the idea of circular reasoning is that we begin with the assumption, we start with the assumption that Jesus was the Messiah. That's the assumption. We're not trying to prove it. We assume that from the outset. He was the Messiah. Now that we know he was the Messiah, we're going to go back to the Bible and find passages that sound like Jesus. And so then anytime there's some kind of an allusion in some way where the passage sounds like Jesus or has some kind of a similarity to Jesus, then it automatically becomes a messianic prophecy because
it sounds from its context and slap the stamp of Jesus on top of it and add it to the list of 365.
That is we're going to see that is usually what takes place. And the reason I feel comfortable saying this, it's simply because the vast majority of honest Christians admit that to be the case. You know, you study Christian commentaries to the Bible. You know, I just to give it as an example, when I spoke to this woman, I wanted to give her an example of where she was not really seeing the Bible up close. And I had her open her Bible to the prophet Zechariah chapter 13, verse 6. And she opened up her King James Bible, and she's reading there where it says, "They will say unto him, what are those wounds in your hand?" And, you know, in her Bible, I found it interesting that that verse was underlined and yellow highlighted and had a star next to it. You know, she really was very much impressed with this verse. And I asked her who it's talking about. And she said, well, it's talking about, you know, she said to me at first, she said, well, you know who it's talking about. And I said, no, tell me. So she said, well, it's talking about Jesus. And I asked her, are you sure that it's talking about Jesus? She said, I'm positive. And I said, how sure are you? She said, I would stake my life on it. So I said, well, you just read chapter 13, verse 6. And I said, why don't you go back to the beginning of the chapter and read from the very beginning? Don't just start at verse 6. So she was reading this chapter from the beginning of the chapter, and I'm sure at one point we'll get into it together. But as she was reading it, I was watching her face, and she turned white like a ghost. And I said, what's wrong? And she started shaking, and she said, this can't be talking about Jesus. And I said, wait a second. You just said a minute ago that you'd stake your life on the fact that it's Jesus. She says, no, it's talking about false prophets. So, you know, here when she looked close up at the Bible and she really studied it carefully, she sees that this is a chapter that's dealing with the topic, really, of false prophets that are going to be exposed ultimately. But what happened is when she first read this chapter, or when someone pointed it out to her, she didn't really care what the chapter was about. You know, she probably was reading this chapter. It didn't really probably relate to her that much. But then she comes to a verse which sounds like Jesus. So that's the verse that she seizes upon. She gets very excited when it says, what are those wounds in your hand? Because Jesus was crucified, he had wounds in his hand. So this passage, which has nothing to do with the Messiah, It's and all Christian commentaries would agree that this is a passage that speaks about false prophets. But in the mind of the apologist, because it has this sort of audio association, you know, it sounds like Jesus because he had wounds in his hands. So this chapter becomes promoted to becoming a messianic prophecy, when in truth, it's not really a passage about the Messiah at all. This is basically what happens in, you know, almost all of these 300 plus passages. It's not a passage that we're going to see that really speaks about the topic of the Messiah or who the Messiah is. It's dealing with something quite different, but because it has some kind of a resonance with Jesus, it's transformed into a messianic prophecy. You know, the famous parable that's given is of the person who shoots his arrow into the tree and then draws the target around it.
Around it. That's right. Exactly right.
So that's what happens here. So I think that, you know, again, one of the most important things that we'll have to bear in mind is to really consider whether the passage that we're examining is really, at the end of the day, a messianic prophecy. Mm-hmm. But then there's one other issue which needs to be thought through and examined, which is the question of circular reasoning. Now, circular reasoning is really what causes people to quote the Bible out of context, meaning that the reason that people will seize upon a passage and attribute to it the status of a messianic prophecy, even when it isn't, is because, again, they're beginning with their assumption and their assertion that Jesus was the Messiah, and there must be proof of that in the Bible. But the idea of circular reasoning goes even a little bit further. Let me give an example. Let's say we were actually to find passages in the Bible that did speak about the Messiah. Now, one of the great problems that we will have with this is that the word the Messiah never really appears in the Bible. You know, that's what's going to make our job a little bit more difficult. And sure, that's really, it lies at the heart of trying to really understand, well, where do you find messianic prophecy in the Bible? But let's say you were to have a passage that actually spoke about the Messiah directly. Let's say there was a passage that you could find which says, the Messiah is going to come. Now, mm-hmm. if you had such a verse, you can assume that, you know, that would make it onto the list of 365 verses. Because, again, the Christian begins their project here with the assumption that Jesus was the Messiah. And if you ask them, well, how do you know this verse, which speaks about the Messiah coming, is speaking about Jesus, they'll say, because he was the Messiah. You say, well, how do you know he's the Messiah? Is it because there are prophecies that point to him? Well,
this
where?
Said that he would come, and he did.
Exactly. So that's going to be another problem that comes up with a number of passages, which is that we have to ask the question, you know, even if a particular passage is about the Messiah, how do we know that it's speaking about Jesus? Meaning maybe it's speaking about someone else that's a true Messiah. And so these two issues are really related. The question of circular reasoning, which would apply even in a case where a particular passage might be speaking about the Messiah. And then we'd have to really determine, well, how do we know for sure that it's identifying Jesus as the subject? And mm-hmm. then the principle of circular reasoning is really what causes people to read the Bible out of context. Because, again, the whole enterprise is not really one in which the person approaches the Bible with a question mark, meaning that the Bible's being approached already with a preordained conclusion. The student here is really has shot their arrow and now is trying to draw the circle around the target around the arrow. You know, the person has already pronounced the judgment. They've had the trial. Now they're looking for evidence. So that's not really the way the Bible needs to be studied. The Bible needs to be studied in its own context without imposing preconceived ideas upon the Bible. You know, I read a book recently, which was a fascinating book by an Israeli social scientist in the United States. His name is Dan Ariely. And the book is called Predictably Irrational. And he's got a very cute story where he describes turning 30 and realizing that it was time that he traded in his motorcycle for a car because he had a family and he needed to transport his kids around. And obviously a motorcycle wasn't going to do. So he had to figure out what car to buy. And he said at the time, the internet was just taking off. And he found a website that provided advice on how to purchase cars. And what you would do is you'd fill out online this questionnaire with many, many questions. And they would ask about, you know, what kind of preferred safety rating you desire to have, and a kind of braking distance, and ideal turning radius, and number of passengers you'd like to take, and many, many questions, what kind of price range. So he went through this exercise, and he put in all the answers to these questions on this questionnaire. And after 15 minutes, he pressed the enter button, submit. Mm-hmm. And out came the answer. The answer was a Ford Taurus. And he was so upset. He said, a Ford Taurus? I mean, that's for an old guy. You know, it's like, I mean, I've been driving a motorcycle for the past 10 years, and I'm going to drive this pedestrian, boring Ford Taurus. He was so upset. So what did he do? He went back to his computer, and he pressed the backwards button. You know, he went back and back and back to get to the beginning of the survey.
How many of us have done that?
And he ended up trying to take the survey again, but this time putting in answers to the questions that he thought would get him to the right answer.
I've done it before.
He ended up, you know, he said, well, it's not so important that I'd be able to take six people in the car. I'll, you know, take four people. And, you know, I don't need such a high rating of safety. And, I can get by with a lower safety standard. And he kept on, you know, every time he would plug in the new answers, you know, he would check to see what car they were pointing to until finally, you know, it recommended a Mazda Miata, which is a real cute little sports car. And he said, oh, you know, finally the computer came up with the right car. You know, so obviously, you know, this whole process was not genuine because he wasn't really looking to the computer here to give him the right answer. He was really trying to impose what he thought the answer was supposed to be.
He was trying to find justification for the answer that he wanted.
Exactly. You know, it's like they say that he's like the captain of the Titanic that's looking for another iceberg. And he's gonna keep on crashing into the wrong Bible passage, you know, until it points to where he wants to point it to.
Mm.
So I think that, you know, to summarize, you know, if we're really trying to look at the Bible honestly with, you know, clear glasses on, you know, rather than looking at the Bible with Jesus-tinted glasses where whatever we see is going to be Jesus. Mm. But we want to really examine the Bible for what the Bible itself teaches clearly and plainly and what the Bible is actually saying, not what we would like it to come out pointing to. And so what we want to be able to do is look at a passage in the Bible with fresh eyes. You know, they tell a story about someone who sends his son to get a suit made up for him, and he gives the son his measurements, and the son goes to the tailor and has the tailor make up a suit, and he brings the suit back, and the father tries it on, and he's very upset, it doesn't fit. So he goes to the tailor, and he's very angry, and the tailor says, well, you know, how did you measure the suit? And you know, the father showed him how he took the measurements, and he said, well, you know, if you want this new suit to fit, you got to take off the old one first. You know, you can't wear two at the same time. So in order to be able to really, you know, read the Bible and get a sense as to what the Bible is actually teaching, we need to take off our preconception glasses and try to see, you know, what it actually is the text saying in terms of its language, in terms of its context, you know, in terms of the immediate context of the chapter and even the broader context of the book in which the chapter comes from.
Mm-hmm.
And another thing to always bear in mind is to see, is the meaning that I'm getting out of this passage consistent with the message of the Bible? And that's an important issue as well. I always speak about in my classes having both clarity and consistency, meaning that we can know that something is accurately understood in the Bible when what we're seeing is both clearly taught, and we already saw the criteria for clarity is when everyone agrees, But another benchmark is when there's consistency, meaning that if we have a passage in the Bible and we have a theory about what the passage means, so if that approach to the passage is something that's taught throughout the Bible consistently, not just in this one place, then we can feel comfortable that our theory holds water. That normally, oftentimes, especially when it comes to important topics in the Bible does not, hold back. And the Bible often will repeat certain things many, many times in many books of the Bible. So, for example, you know, is it important to observe the Sabbath? Yes, the Bible says that quite often. Or is it important to avoid idolatry? Yes, the Bible says that quite often. Or is it important to remember that the Jews were redeemed from Egypt? And we should never forget the fact that we were slaves in Egypt. Yeah, the Bible repeats that many, many times. Is it possible for us to achieve forgiveness of our sins by turning from them and repenting? Yeah, the Bible says that hundreds of times. So when we have a passage and we're not clear about what it means, if we can find parallels where a similar theme is discussed and we can see clarity elsewhere, that can be helpful in knowing that we are on the right approach to understanding a passage which we have a question mark about.
Certainly.
So I think those are things, those are guidelines that will be helpful for our investigations to make sure that we're working with an accurate translation, to make sure that we're reading a passage in its proper context, to make sure that we're not approaching the Bible with preconceived ideas, that we don't have an agenda when we read the Bible. We're letting the Bible speak to us on its own terms, and that we want to, explore not just the immediate context of what a chapter says that surrounds a particular verse, but what is the general context of the Bible, meaning that if the Bible has a particular point of view throughout the entire Bible, it's going to be difficult to insist that a particular verse contradicts that general approach of the entire Bible.
That's right. And so we would encourage the listeners to look up these lists of 300-plus prophecies that were fulfilled by Yeshua, supposedly, and have a look and apply some of those guidelines that you just gave us, Rabbi Skobach, and see whether it does hold water. Now, we're going to come back next time and have a closer look at some of these. Obviously, we can't go through all 365 of them, or whatever is the count of any particular list. There's quite a lot there. But some of the ones in the spotlight, as so often they can be, they're the ones that we want to look at. And particularly if you, dear listener, if you go through a list and you have a particular question about any particular number, please send us the link and the number, or at least the passage that you would like us to look at. And we'll see if we can fit that into the recording as well and put that one under the microscope. You can leave that in the comments of this post. So thank you, Rabbi Michael Skobach, for coming on to Truth to You and sharing with us the rules of play, so to speak, when looking at a list like this. Really appreciate you coming on to Truth to You for the first time.
It's my great pleasure.
Looking forward to having you back. In the meantime, dear listeners, visit jewsforjudaism.ca. jewsforjudaism.ca is the website. You'll find an immense amount of information there as well. Well worth going to. And thank you again, my friend. In the meantime, dear listeners, be blessed and be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom.
Shalom, shalom.